pal Ariel Helwani on this Wednesday, June 12th, 2019. Hope you're doing well. Welcome to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters right here on ESPN. We have a lot to discuss this week, and we've got a nice little trio of reporters who will be joining us. Later in the program, we'll be joined by ESPN's own Jeff Wagenheim. We'll recap UFC 238 and talk about the aftermath in particular. Where does Henry Cejudo go from here? Tony Ferguson, Valentina Shevchenko, people like that. It was a fun night in Chicago. And again, I want to thank everyone who attended our very first Helwani Roadshow Friday night at Lincoln Hall. It was incredible. Still buzzing over it. I'm still on a high over the whole thing. The trivia contest was great. It was somewhat of a surprise ending. The fans were great. The turnout was great. The love was great. I'm hoping we'll do many more of these. And again, if you missed it, you can download the show right now on the feed. So, and I have to say, Daniel and the team did a great job producing it. It sounds great. Usually when you do something in front of a live audience, it could sound a little funky, but no, this sounded great. It was a lot of fun, and I appreciate all the positive feedback. So that was great. Chicago was great. 238 was great. And now there's a whole new set of topics to talk about. Also, we'll be joined by New York Rick. We'll talk about some news and notes. There was just a press conference in London for the Khabib Poirier fight. We'll talk about Zhang Weili getting the title shot against Jessica Andrade in China. We'll talk a little Chris Cyborg. We'll talk all those things and more. But first, let us turn our attention to this weekend. There is no UFC this weekend, but there's a really good Bellator card headlined by Neiman Gracie versus Roy McDonald for the Bellator welterweight title. Of course, the semifinals of the Bellator welterweight Grand Prix. The other finalist has been booked. Douglas Lima beat MVP back in May, so he's in the finale. And the winner of this fight is obviously going to fight him in the finale to determine the winner of the Grand Prix, determine the champion, and also the winner gets $1 million courtesy of the great 50 Cent. But like I said, it's a great card top to bottom. You've got Chael Sonnen against Lyoto Machida. You've got Kyoji Horiguchi against Darren Caldwell. You've got the return of Dylan Dennis and Heather Hardy. There's a lot to like there. And so for more on this card, let us go to our first guest of the day who's actually in New York. He's not a New Yorker, but he's in New York to cover this great Bellator 222 card for The Athletic. He is the OG himself, veteran Josh Gross, joins us first on the program, his first appearance on the MMA Reporters. Josh, how are you?
I'm great. Currently sitting in the theater at Madison Square Garden, Ariel.
Wow.
So enjoying it, yes. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you on the show. Despite your constant trolling of me on Twitter, you see, I'm a mensch. I'll still extend the olive branch and have you on. I'm happy to have you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here, Josh, and it's good to have you back in the mix. Congratulations on the Athletic news. Are you happy to be back on the beat?
Very happy. Yeah, it's a great opportunity. So far, so great with The Athletic. We've assembled a wonderful team. Happy to be a part of it. And, the MMA world, I missed it. It was to be back full time. It's a little daunting. The space has shifted and changed. I feel like I need to knock some of the rust off, but I'm excited to do so and jump right back in there.
It's like you're a rookie all over again. That's good. That gets you excited. The blood is boiling. It's good to have you in the mix.
It's always okay to be a white belt and go back to your fundamentals. There's you can do that in any walk of life, and I'm happy to do that right now.
Amazing. All right. You know, I remember, by the way, I remember May of 2008, the very first Elite XC on CBS card. There was a press conference at Times Square in New York, and you just got the job with Sports Illustrated, and I did an interview with you for MMA Radio because that was the biggest deal in the world that someone had broken through and gotten a mainstream job. Do you remember this interview at all?
Of course I remember it. Yes, I remember it very well.
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy. Here we are 11 years later. I'm with ESPN. You're with The Athletic. Everything's good in the world. So let's talk about this card. Like I said, I like it very much. A lot of intriguing names, a lot of intriguing fights. If I had to ask you right now, which storyline are you most intrigued by going into Friday night? What's your answer?
Storyline. You and storylines, Ariel. Uh-huh. I got to say, all things considered, I mean, I think for me, the thing that ticks all the boxes is the Horiguchi-Caldwell fight. continuation of what happened in December in Japan. The fact that you have two promoters putting their champions against one another is a big deal. I think you can make a case that Kyoji Horiguchi is the best Japanese mixed martial artist we've ever seen. And, you know, there's a lot of intrigue there for me on a lot of different levels. One individual fighter, I think the plight of Rory McDonald is extremely compelling. You know, what does he have left? Where is he? Those answers I think we're going to find out against Neiman Gracie, you know, on Friday.
Okay, so let me first ask you about Horiguchi and Caldwell, because they first met in late December, New Year's Eve show, Ryzen. Horiguchi gets the win. Now they run it back in the cage for the Bellator title. You wrote a story about co-promotion in this sport and this particular one and the history of it a little bit. And my colleague Mark Ramundi wrote a story as well for ESPN. And this is fascinating because people need to know that Kyoji Horiguchi is a Ryzen fighter. Darren Caldwell is a Bellator fighter. And yet Scott Coker, Bellator president, and Nobuyuki Sakakibara of Ryzen, formerly of Pride, they work well together. Why do these two seem to work so well together, and why do they seem to be able to figure out how to co-promote, how to share talent, when the majority of other promoters don't seem to be able to do that in MMA?
Well, first off, MMA is a closed world, and just the way that the organizations have been structured, you haven't seen a lot of talent sharing, let alone co-promotion in the sense that we go from boxing, where there's a split of the revenue pie, and everybody is like part of the promotion. And Friday night, Ryzen is not a part of this promotion whatsoever. They don't have a hand in the revenue. They're not selling the fight. They're not doing anything. They're here to support their fighter who they've lent to Bellator in an exchange. So it's a bit of a handshake agreement between two guys who have known each other for a long time and who have a really good working relationship. 2006 was the first time that Scott Coker went to Sakakibara. He knew him from Kinemai, who had contacts with K1, and said, hey, you know, I'm just sort of starting my organization. This was the very beginning of Strikeforce. You know, could you send over a fighter? And Sakakibara, like, he went with it, and he sent him over a main event of Alistair Overeem and Vitor Belfort. And they've had these sort of exchanges off and on over the last 13 years. And, you know, I think they come from the same place, and they recognize that sometimes when you combine forces, you can be much stronger than when you go solo. Clearly, both can promote great fights on their own. But, you know, in instances like this, there's an openness to discovering who's the best. Who's the best mixed martial artist? Not going to be determined that. I'm willing to put my champion up. Are you willing to do it? And, you know, I think that in that way that there's a common connection between them and a common view of this world. They're not, you know, they're not operating in the closed space that we know that the UFC does. The UFC from time to time did loan out fighters. They did it with Pride. Chuck Liddell went into what I think is the best Pride tournament of all time. And, you know, they've had some mixed experiences with those. No one's expecting them to go off and co-promote. Dana White, I think, last week said that it wasn't something that he was interested in. He told The Athletic that. And you can understand why. But I do think it robs the sport, and I say sport on purpose, I think it robs mixed martial arts of some of the things that make boxing still so powerful. It's like, who is the best in the world? Well, I know who the best in your promotion is, and he may or may not be, or she may or may not be the best in the world. And, you know, anything that gets us closer to answering the questions of who's the best, Henry Cejudo is a hell of a fighter, Ariel, like unbelievable fighter. But you know what? Kyoji Horiguchi is a hell of a fighter. And when you're talking about the best mixed martial artist from Japan ever, I mean, people are calling him that. Sakakibara called him that. I'd like to see him fight Henry Cejudo if he beats Darian Caldwell again, because I think he's got a chance to win that fight. And finally on this point, you know, I kind of make a point of saying that there are no world championships, no world titles in mixed martial arts the way that the sport is structured. On Friday, the Bellator world bantamweight title is on the line, right? But it's not really. Just like the way that Henry Cejudo says, I'm the world champion. You're not really the world champion. You're a promotional champion. And that's a great and a powerful thing in its own way. But I think there's a larger thing to fight for. And to me, these events make that happen. And Scott Coker and Sakakibara at this moment in time seem to be willing to work together to, you know, engineer a moment that they think it's a small step maybe to something larger in the long run, that, you know, we can see more of an open universe in mixed martial arts.
Do you ever foresee a day where it is a little more open, that we see more of this? Or do you think that for the foreseeable future, at least in our lifetime, it's always going to be, as long as the UFC is the dominant brand, it's always going to be these one-offs here and there, but never quite like in boxing?
I think it'd be very difficult to be like boxing. The structure of the sport's totally different. The way that the fighters have controls of their career is entirely different. And again, like, this is just the two guys with a handshake agreement. It's not like Saki Kibara and Scott Coker had to hammer out all the financials and get an army of lawyers involved and do the whole thing that comes with a boxing co-promotion. Coker did that with Pro Elite. You remember, he did two actual co-promotions with Pro Elite back in the day. And for his, as far as he's concerned, they were both successful. So he's open to it. But I have a hard time imagining the UFC in the position that they're in has any really motivation, because the public perception is that if you're in the UFC, you're the UFC champion, you're the best. That's the public perception. In a lot of cases, it's true, but in some cases, it may not be. And, I think that there's really no reason for them to back off that point and pursue something else. I hope so, because the thing I want more than anything is to know who's the best fighter in the world. To me, mixed martial arts answers the question in terms of a skill perspective. There's no doubt in my mind that the best mixed martial artist would beat the best boxer or karate stylist or wrestler or individual martial artist in whatever they're doing. But then amongst the mixed martial artists, who's the best? Sometimes we know, sometimes we don't. And I wish it was sort of a more sure footing in terms of those questions answered. And I don't think things are going to shift, but the industry is always moving. And, if the public responds, and it's really up to the public, I think, Ariel, more than anything, they responded in a nice way to the Horiguchi-Caldwell fight the first time. If they respond to these kinds of fights and promoters notice that, there's the potential. But I think it's likely a long ways off before this is a regular piece of the business.
I was talking to Chael earlier, and he said to me that he believes one of the reasons why Dana White doesn't like to co-promote, and of course the times are very different, but he claims that Dana was burned by Pride when he sent Chuck over there. Were you covering the sport back then when Chuck went over there to fight?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Dana was actually burned the other way. He was burned because Vanderlei Silva was supposed to come to the UFC, and it just never happened.
Well, that was supposed to be in return, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so there is truth to that.
Yeah, no question. It just never came to pass. I think doing business with Pride at the time was more difficult than it is maybe with Saki Kibara at this particular moment. Obviously, Ryzen is not Pride or what Pride was. But definitely the UFC dabbled in it, and they were open to it. When Zuffa purchased the UFC from SEG, the initial press conferences and the initial interviews that Dana White and all these guys did, Lorenzo Fertitta, they openly talked about wanting Pride versus UFC, wanting their best to fight Sakuraba, wanting to do co-promotions. They talked about this. They've gotten away from it a long time ago, and I don't think that they have really any motivation to move back to that position. But that was their initial view on how they wanted this world to operate. And, I think there's a lot of merit and a lot of good that can come from that, but it's also trickier. You're giving up control that you have now, and public perception. All of a sudden, perhaps you think you're putting promoters on par with your promotion. You can look at it a lot of ways. You can look at it like you're betting on your fighter. What's wrong with that? I mean, the UFC, are they not confident that their champions would beat champions from other organizations? And what's the worst thing that would happen if they lost? I mean, if you look at soccer, what Saki Kibara is trying to do in establishing Ryzen is essentially create a champions league where champions from other promotions come in and they fight in a Ryzen sanctioned tournament, and the best fighter there emerges as the best in the world. Now, that seems like a big long shot, because why would any promoter want to put their champion under another brand and then have them win or lose? But the idea that the UFC is so objecting to working with other promoters, it took them a little while to get to that position. That's not where they started. They initially came in wanting an open universe because they saw the benefit in that for people who are just starting to get rolling and trying to build something. It's very beneficial for people like that. It's also beneficial at the end of the day when you have a major fight that doesn't get made, and it should. I mean, I always think to what happened with Randy Couture and Fedor Emelianenko. That was going to be the biggest fight in the world. That was going to be the biggest fight in mixed martial arts, and it didn't happen because the UFC refused under the business arrangements to make it come together. And so, I think there's positives and negatives on both sides. For me, and I think for most fans, they probably just want to say, well, what's the best fight? What's going to produce the best fight, the most meaningful fight? And I think sometimes it's just a fact of life that one promoter is not going to control both sides of the fight. That's fight business tradition. But in mixed martial arts, it's absolutely trended in the other way, where the promoter wants control of both sides of the fight. And I don't think that's the healthiest thing for the business. I don't think it's the healthiest thing for fighters, for a few different reasons.
It's kind of amazing that here we are just a couple of days away from Rory McDonald returning to the cage when not that long ago he was in the cage following his draw against John Fitch, talking about how, you know, he doesn't want to hurt people anymore and how he's talking to God and all that stuff and more. You've been there for a couple of days now. I'm wondering if you've had a chance to observe him at all, and do you have any concerns about Rory McDonald's mental state going into this fight?
Yeah, I interviewed him last week over the phone. I saw him today at the open workouts. He didn't do an open workout. He just addressed the public that was outside here at Madison Square Garden. Look, he says that he's found a balance, and this is something that he's contemplated and considered and sat down with his wife and really tried to get a handle on what he was feeling and thinking, trying to live a life because he's now got one. I mean, this is a new version of Rory McDonald outside the cage. And at the same time, trying to be an elite mixed martial artist, an elite competitor. And balancing those things, I think, has proven difficult for him. But he seems to believe that he's figured it out. I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced he has. I think it's a tough fight, even if he's 100%. I think Neiman Gracie is a difficult fight for him because I think highly of Neiman Gracie. So I don't know. I don't know, but I think this fight will tell us one way or the other. It's a quick turnaround. You know, he couldn't really get back in the gym. He had to take a couple weeks off recovering from some injuries from the Fitch fight and also getting his head straight. That's really quick. You know, he says that he's still in shape from the first training camp, but it's not ideal. He seemed pretty happy to be done with this fight training and into the fight when I spoke to him. And I don't know if that's an indication of anything in particular, but I'll just say that I'm not convinced that the Rory McDonald that fought Robbie Lawler exists anymore. I think that was a life-altering fight for him. It really was, professionally and personally. And, you know, he's still working his way through what that means.
I'm not convinced that if he loses, this isn't his last fight. I feel like we're a loss away from seeing the end of Rory McDonald, just based off what he's saying. And King Mo told me on Monday when he heard him say that, he thought he was speaking to him. He's like, yes, I feel the same way, and this is why I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to hurt people. Do you agree?
I think if he loses, there'll be a serious conversation that he's going to have, if he hasn't had it already, about walking away. I think if he wins this fight and goes ahead and beats Douglas Lima, I think he may walk away. It just sounds like life is trending away from fighting for Rory McDonald. Now, he may prove us all differently, prove us all wrong, but I don't necessarily feel like he's in it for the long haul anymore. And, you know, how could he be? I mean, it seems like the same position to do that. It seems like the thing to do, especially after the wars that he's been in. And, you know, fans get so caught up in, like, what they want from fighters, what they expect from fighters. And I think sometimes they forget these are real human beings, you know, and they've got lives to live and they've got a lot of time to deal with once their careers are done. It's a hard thing to transition away from, even if you've done it in the best possible ways. When you're coping with a lot of anxiety or social issues, or you're coping with the fact that, you know, what you thought you once knew is real is maybe not as real as you thought it was in terms of how the world worked or anything. People are shifting and evolving constantly, and I think we're in the middle of an evolution change of Rory McDonald. He called it a new chapter when I spoke to him. And, you know, I don't know what that leads to, but I wouldn't be surprised like you if it was cut short here.
And so this is why I go back to my initial question, and despite the fact that you scoffed at my use of the word storyline, there's storylines galore here, Josh. You got the Rory McDonald story. That's fascinating theater. Like, I can't wait to see what kind of Rory McDonald we see on Friday. We talked about the co-promotion. Now I have to ask you about Dylan Danis, a grizzled veteran like yourself, a guy who's been around this sport for almost two decades. What do you make of Dylan Danis?
I don't know. Just win some fights, and then it's like I can pay attention.
You know, he's not worth your time.
But that's how I feel about most fighters these days. Honestly, like if you're in the UFC and you, most fighters who are in the UFC, you'll need to have gone three fights into the UFC for me to really pay attention to you, and you'll have to have gone at least 2-1. You know, to because there's just so much mixed martial arts and so many competitors, and once in a while people break through, but. You know, yeah, sure. Am I grizzled veteran or jaded or whatever you want to say? I don't know. It's tough to stand out. And when people are screaming, hey, look at me, look at me, look at me, that has the opposite effect most of the time, as far as I'm concerned, just from my point of view. It may work in other places. People, fans may love that stuff. For me, it doesn't. I just want to see, well, okay, let's see what happens when you fight and you fight somebody good. And Dylan Danis may, you know, he may do it. He may be the guy who like sort of busts out here and he tells everybody how stupid they were for not believing in him. I just prove it. That's where I'm at. And one of the great things about when people do compete in this sport is they get a chance to prove it. And so that, you know, we'll wait and see on him.
And by the way, when I say grizzled veteran, I don't mean jaded. I just mean you've been around.
No, I was talking about me.
Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough. I don't want you to think
Some people may take my comments as that way. They're not. Like, I highly respect anybody who steps in the cage. I understand the reality of what that means and what they're putting on the line and everything. Believe me, I do. But there's just so much to take in these days that I feel like fighters, it's not good enough just to be in the UFC or to be Bellator and all of a sudden, we really got to pay attention to you. You got to do something within those organizations now, especially as we were talking about earlier, how everything is sort of closed world. You know, make your way in your own little pool here, or big pool, as it were, if you're in the UFC, and, you know, then we can start paying attention. And that's how I feel about a guy like Dylan Danis. You know, all the talk, all the noise, for me, it doesn't mean anything. You know, we'll see who you are when push comes to shove and things get really tough and they match you against somebody who can push you back. And that's what I'm looking forward to seeing with him.
When they announced this fight between Chael Sonnen and Lyoto Machida, I did not like the fight for Chael. I feel like this is a much better matchup for Machida. Machida has made a living off of fighting wrestlers who, you know, get a little impatient, rush in. He catches them, of course, famously against, you know, Ryan Bader, Sugar Rashad. But he's done this throughout his career. Do you agree with me? Do you agree that this is a bad matchup for Chael?
I don't know if I do or don't. I mean, Chael is a guy who doesn't get hurt in fights. He generally protects himself. He'll, you know, find a way out if he needs to. I mean, if he can wrestle Lyoto, he wins the fight. And he can wrestle Lyoto. Why can't he do that?
Lyoto's hard to take down.
Yeah, but he can still wrestle on him and grind him and slow him down and stifle Lyoto. I mean, he can't stand on the outside. Chael can box a little bit, but I don't think he's going to want to do that. And Lyoto's 41, you know, is that how old he is? I think so.
Yeah, 42.
So, you know, we're talking about a guy who's got a lot of mileage on him. And, you know, I don't, these kinds of fights are tough for me to take in, you know.
What do you mean by that?
What's the point of it? We know neither of them are going to be elite competitors anymore. Neither of them is going to be a contender anymore. So that's two names, two fighters who fought a long time and they're capitalizing on it, and that's great for them. But for me as a viewer, as a spectator, it doesn't do anything for what I'm really interested in, you know? So in that way, I'm probably more interested in what happens with Dylan Danis than the result of this.
Wow.
Fight.
Wow. You actually gave Dylan Danis a compliment. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, he's a young kid undefeated. That's always interesting to me.
Right.
I'm highly, highly intrigued by that.
There is a market though in Bellator for fights like this, right? I mean, this is what Scott Coker
market
does.
Everywhere for it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the UFC's not above doing fights like this. Ryzen does them. Bellator does them.
Right.
I mean, but Combate just signed Tito Ortiz. It's like if you have a name and a face and you can be put on a poster and the public identifies with you, you still have a place in this sport. Very different than boxing in that way, where if you're exposed as a competitor, you kind of disappear very quickly. So, you know, you can say it's a good or a bad thing. I'm not judging it, but it's just a reality of what the sport looks like. And there are people who have not had a chance to see Chael Sonnen or Lyoto Machida fight before in person, who live in New York, who see them on the card and be like, oh, wow, I want to see those guys. And there's people who say like, oh, they're on the card and that's cool. I want to watch them. And oh, wow, I get all these other great fights. So I totally understand the signing fighters like this. You know, it sounds like Fedor Emelianenko may come back to Bellator. So, you know, these guys don't go away easy. They really don't.
One last quick thing before I let you go. Aaron Pico, he's back. He needs a win, right? It's always like it's always like the biggest thing when Aaron Pico fights and then he loses and everyone wants to, you know, do this referendum on if he's overhyped, if he wasn't worthy of it, all that stuff and more. Do you still have hope? Did you ever have hope that he could turn into what we all thought he could?
Sure. I mean, you listen to Bob Cook. How could you not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob Cook's been in the room with everybody. He's trained everybody. And like when he's saying this is the best talent I've ever been around in my life, you listen to that. And, you know, I think that there was so much put on his shoulders to be great from the very beginning. And he didn't fight to his strength. He made a decision to go and look for knockouts and be a showman. I don't know that I can. Has he ever gotten a takedown in a fight? He may have gotten one or two. you know, this is not someone who's figured out how to be a mixed martial artist and is willing to use all parts of his game. And if he chooses to do that, he can still be very, very dangerous. Yes, I'm intrigued by Aaron Pico, but the fact is, you're right. If he loses, and he could lose on Friday, he's 4-3. He's 4-3.
Amazing.
Does that make him the biggest bust of all time? I don't know. I mean, he's still a young kid. But for a young kid, he's got a lot of mileage and a lot of wear and tear, and you wonder about that. And, you know, what does it mean for him as a competitor to have started this way? You know, a lot of great fights. If you go back and look at a lot of great fighters earlier in their career, they've lost. And, you know, he's not going to be any different than that if he rebounds and rights the ship and gets on a streak and all of a sudden, you know, Bellator can start pushing him as a contender and, oh, my God, he's fighting for a title. I mean, that doesn't seem crazy to me. That could certainly happen. But this is a big fight. It is for him. Not a lot of people know who Adam Borax is. He's a good fighter. But if he goes out and beat Pico, I think people will just chalk it up to Pico being the bust. And that's probably not fair to him. I don't think it is. That's just kind of how the game works, though.
Storylines, Josh. Storylines. They got him galore.
The human beings, the stories are everywhere. I'm with you on that. I just give me the fights and the results. That's where my stories start.
It's good to have you back. And the podcast coming back as well, correct?
Cross Point Blank will be on The Athletic in July, correct.
All right. I look forward to that. Thanks for doing this, Josh, and I appreciate you doing it right before the media day. Good luck out there, and I'll see you on Friday.
Thank you, Ariel.
All right, there he is, Josh Gross. Been doing this for a very long time. A veteran, an OG, somewhat of a curmudgeon, but that's why we love him. It's good to have him back on the beat. Great insight as far as Bellator 222 is concerned. And like I said, I mean, there's a lot to like here. If you're in the tri-state area, first of all, you can get to go to a card at MSG. There's only been four prior to this one at MSG. The three UFC cards, 205, 217, 230 this past November. And then, of course, the Bellator 180 card that was headlined a couple of years ago by Chael Sonnen versus Vanderlei Silva. Roy McDonald against Neiman Gracie. Lyoto Machida against Chael Sonnen. Dylan Danis against Max Humphrey. Ricky Bandejas returning against Patrick Mix. Juan Archuleta against Eduardo Dantas. And Darion Caldwell against Kyoji Horiguchi. That's the main card, but these names are fighting on the prelims. Aaron Pico, Heather Hardy, Valerie Lareda, Robson Gracie, Mike Kimball, Chaim Gonzalez, Phil Hawes. Those are some good names. Those are names. Usually the Bellator prelims are a little thin. Not in this case. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll be there covering it on Friday. All right. Let us turn our attention now to some other news and notes and say hello to my good pal, New York Rick, who was with me in Chicago last week for the first ever Helwani Road Show. New York Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ariel. How are you?
How much fun was that?
It was the greatest thing.
Greatest? Wow. High praise.
It was special. It was sentimental. You and I have been together for a long time doing the show that had another name previously and is now...
It was always the Helwani show, all right? It was always the Helwani show. Let's be real. Same show.
And we've wanted to do that live format for a long time. The team at ESPN pulled it together flawlessly. The fighters delivered. You delivered. It was an incredible night. And most importantly, the fans showed up and delivered too. So it was special. It was truly special.
Dare I say you delivered as well. You are our, what was it, like scorekeeper? You almost screwed up at the end
there,
but I won't hold you to it. No, it was great.
The audio people don't know any of that.
Exactly.
So let's pretend that never happened. But my math was on point that night, that's for sure.
Corporate Jake wasn't there. You were there. So now we know where the true allegiance is.
Yeah, we know the hierarchy.
Yeah.
The pecking order is clear. It's still me, and then somewhere down near the very bottom is Corporate Jake.
And let me just say, I was shocked by the winner. I'll maybe address who the winner is, just in case there's someone out there who hasn't listened to it yet. I was shocked by the winner. It was a nice surprise. It was a lot of fun, and I think the trivia format is great. And something again outside of the live show, I've been wanting to do a trivia show, MMA trivia show. I did it once for UFC Tonight back in the day. I've always felt like the sport was perfect for something like that, so it was a lot of fun to do. Now, let's talk about earlier today, press conference, London, Khabib, Poirier, UFC 242, Abu Dhabi. They did it in London. First face-off, biggest takeaway from the presser was?
That Khabib Nurmagomedov is moving on from Conor McGregor is my overarching takeaway. When they asked him you know, what it would take to be number one pound for pound. He listed three names, and none of them are Conor McGregor. He listed Dustin Poirier, who's his currently booked opponent, Tony Ferguson, who I think in most people's mind is the next contender for that division, and then George St. Pierre, a legendary fighter who hasn't made a run at lightweight yet, but Khabib versus GSP is a fight that Khabib's team has talked about and GSP has talked about. So those three names were thrown out, and then asked, you know, about Conor McGregor. His response was that, you know, Conor McGregor had fought one time in 3 years, and it was an amateur boxing contest that he lost. He's not particularly interested in that fight. He tapped and begged for his life last time. So Khabib is, you know, there's clearly still a wound there. There's clearly still some animosity, but I think his career is moving on while Conor McGregor is kind of outside of that sphere.
So that was my biggest takeaway, but it's coupled with what we heard on Saturday as well. I feel like Tony Ferguson on Saturday after the win over Cerrone said the same kind of thing. I want the title. Let's go. Let's go. And then Khabib said the same sort of thing here. He talked about, you know, who he wants next, Tony, GSP, all that and more. And it feels like, correct me if you feel otherwise, it feels like we're starting to see a shift here. The money fight era seems like it's slowly starting to go away and guys want to fight for the belt. And maybe it's because they're getting paid accordingly. And let's be honest, that's thanks to Conor. Maybe it's because they're sort of tired of the nonsense. But I'm starting to get the feeling that Khabib and Ferguson are almost boxing out Conor and saying, we don't need you. Khabib is getting paid very well. We know that. We know that Tony got a new contract, so he got a bump there, no doubt, especially to take a fight on, you know, like 3-4 weeks notice. I feel like we're starting to finally see a shift where the fighters are saying, money fights be damned. Let me go for the belt. I get paid when I'm a champion, and I'm starting to get paid accordingly. I don't need to chase the Conor fight, the money fight, so to speak. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know exactly what you're saying. I agree with the sentiment. You might even say Tony Ferguson's champ-ish only is the new motto. It's really about that title. And Tony Ferguson's been the one kind of beating that drum for a very long time. And now it seems like everybody else is on board. I'll say this, though. I agree with you with the caveat that it's easy to say that while the Conor fight is not materializing, while it's not in front of you. If offered the biggest money fight, I think it would be very hard to turn it down. So, you know, in practice, in interviews with the media, it's very easy to say that. When that opportunity is presented, I think that's where the rubber really meets the road. So if Conor McGregor says, hey, I'm coming back tomorrow and I want my fight, my rematch with Khabib, I have a hard time feeling that the UFC wouldn't want it. And then when the dollar signs are negotiated, that Khabib wouldn't want it as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that fight, though. It's good to have Khabib back. It's good to have him in the mix. It's good to see him at a press conference. It's actually quite nice to have him at a press conference for the first time in a long time where it doesn't feel uncomfortable, where it doesn't feel like it's just dripping with like animosity and hatred. Like there wasn't really much of that. You know, they're both competitive and they're saying their own things, but it was sort of refreshing to see him in the old light. Cause again, I'll say like the Khabib Conor stuff, I felt like it just brought out the worst in both of them. And it was starting to get a little tiresome. This felt good. This felt a little more pure.
Yeah, there was no personal vendetta there. There was no animosity at that level that there was for Conor Khabib. There was clearly respect. You know, Dustin essentially said that he doesn't really see holes in Khabib's game. He's going to have to create them, which I thought was interesting because, you know, he's been asked a lot, you know, where are the holes? And his point was, I don't necessarily see holes. I'm going to have to make holes with my pressure, which I thought was interesting and a sign of respect for Khabib's overall game. The one thing that I, you know, found most interesting, obviously, outside of the Conor conversation was Khabib saying essentially that after every fight, he enjoys the sport less and less. Now, I don't think that's a secret to people. I think as you kind of get longer in your career, it's harder to keep that motivation up. You know, he's been champion now. He's achieved a lot of things in this sport already at a pretty young age. But, you know, he was asked about sitting out and whether he misses the sport. And he said, not really. I think that's kind of interesting because he's been talking about, you know, these three fights that he wants before he walks away. I could see Khabib, you know, conceivably in the next couple of years leaving the sport and with not a lot of fights left on his resume. So I thought that comment was interesting that, you know, he wasn't he wasn't feeling that itch while he's been sitting out. He's loving the sport less and less.
All right. We'll talk more about Ferguson and this potential fight later on with Jeff Wagenheim. But for now, let's turn our attention. And by the way, just want to say, I don't know if I buy that 100%. It seems like the sport is doing him very well. But it's always interesting to hear a guy, especially that young and undefeated, talk like that. But I want to ask you about this title fight that was announced yesterday. And that's Jessica Andrade has agreed to go to China to fight Zhang Weili. Now, by the way, it's the correct pronunciation is Zhang Weili, not Weili Zhang. It's sort of like Yao Ming. Yao was his last name, Ming his first name, but that's how you're supposed to say it. So it's actually Zhang Weili. Just want to let everyone know. And it's going down August 31st. And this one raised some eyebrows. Initially, I think a lot of people were very much caught off guard by it all. What do you make of this decision by the UFC?
Yeah, I think it's an appropriate business decision. In a division where there isn't really a clear-cut contender. I don't think there's any doubt that if Tatiana Suarez was able to, make a statement last Saturday in Chicago, that she would have been the one that everybody was clamoring for, but she didn't. She didn't really impress in that performance. I think people were expecting something a little more dominant out of her, and she didn't deliver that. I also think there's some trepidation around Michelle Waterson. I don't think she's done anything to really make her stamp there. She's picked up some nice wins. She's on a very nice streak. She's obviously a marketable fighter, but I don't think she was the clear-cut number one contender either. The fact that Tatiana Suarez and Nina Ansarova fight that hadn't happened yet was still kind of on people's radar while Michelle was waiting there was a sign that she wasn't that clear number one contender. So I don't necessarily think that there's any issue with this. It's clearly a marketing play and a good one to have a Chinese challenger in home territory facing a champion. And credit, as we've been talking about with this strawweight division for a while now, credit to Jessica Andrade for going into enemy territory and defending her belt.
Yeah, she's sort of returning the favor here in the sense that Rose went to Brazil to defend her title against her, and now she's obviously not returning the favor to Rose, although she did say she would return the favor to Rose and actually go to Colorado. She's now doing the same thing by going to China. I will say, okay, the one thing that you failed to mention was Suarez is hurt. Suarez has an injured neck, and so it's very tough to ask her to turn around that quickly, and quite frankly, she shouldn't, and she can't. So she's out of the picture, and I also don't think that she wowed the crowd on Saturday. I don't think there's a lot of buzz surrounding her fighting, fighting for the belt right now. Waterson was the only other real option left, and I think that she's done a good job of getting people behind her. She's definitely very popular, and she's trying to do this whole fight mom thing. I really thought that they were going to give it to her, if only because she's represented by WME, and she doesn't have that many years left. And so I feel like, look, this isn't the most egregious decision of all time. Zhang is very talented. She's incredible, actually. She's vicious in there. She looks very, quiet and unassuming, but she's a killer in there, and she's 3-0 in the UFC. She's won 18 in a row overall. She's very deserving of being discussed in the title picture. She just doesn't have that signature win. She was never positioned as someone who was fighting for the number one contender spot, fighting for a shot at the belt. She was never in that spot. So that's why initially I think the reaction was like, whoa, where did this come from? And then of course you consider the China part of it all, and you consider how big of a market that is. You consider the PI that they're building over there and how it's so rare to have a Chinese contender. They've never had one in the UFC. It's rare to have one in boxing and kickboxing. It makes a lot of sense for the UFC to do this. I'll say all that to say, if they didn't have this location on the books, if they didn't have this date already set, I have a hard time believing that they give her this shot. You know what I mean? I feel like if this was some random event in Brazil or the U.S. and China wasn't on the books for 2019, Zhang is probably not fighting for the belt.
No, completely agree with you. And, that's the reality of the fight business, is the timing is so crucial. The fact that she's an unknown helps her in this case, because I think you have to make the calculation, if you're the UFC, that you've got a really good prospect, but you don't know if you have a championship level prospect. The level of competition she's faced hasn't been as high as some of the other strawweight contenders have faced, but it's been high enough that you do know you have a you have a blue chipper, you have a top prospect. You can put her into this title fight, and it won't be a complete farce, but at the same time, she's not potentially damaged by taking other fights and then losing to another top contender. You're really striking while the iron's hot with somebody that is clearly a very talented fighter and makes sense for the market that you're going into. So I think, you know, the fact that she actually hasn't faced the top competition was in her favor in this case because she was able to rack up those wins. If she had been in the strawweight grinder, there's a chance that she doesn't get past a Tatiana Suarez or somebody in of that ilk, and then you ruin a potential title contender in China. So business-wise, from a business decision, I think it's lined up perfectly, and the timing was, you know, what kind of dictated this matchup.
The other one, of course, that we have to talk about is Rose Namajunas. By all accounts, she is not going to retire, and there were some talks. They did reach out to her about doing the immediate rematch, but she's not ready as well. She had an injured neck going into that fight against Jessica Andrade, and now, of course, she clearly banged her neck up in that fight against Andrade, getting dropped on her head. It would be way too soon for her. But that's like it's. I'm happy to hear that she's not walking away because she looked so good in that fight. And I wouldn't be surprised if her next fight is for the belt whenever she does decide to return. So anyone, I bring that up only to say because anyone who was upset that she wasn't being discussed or wasn't getting the title shot, they did reach out to her. She's just not ready to come back.
Yeah, and just to put a cap on this, I think, you know, for all the discussion about, you know, whether she's the most deserving or not, a win over Tisha Torres is an impressive win and matters. I don't have a problem with somebody beating Tisha Torres and getting a title shot.
Yeah. They also were having a lot of trouble finding an opponent for Zhang. I know that. She even wanted to fight Joanna Jędrzejczyk, and I don't know if Joanna actually turned it down, but this is definitely something that has been discussed. So they're having trouble. China, the stars align. And look, far be it for me. I always criticize the UFC about not taking title fights to the right location. This one is like, whew, you hit the jackpot with this one. You have someone who's on the cusp of being a contender. She would only be one fight away at this point, so I don't mind the expediting. I do feel bad for Michelle Waterson. I'm not going to lie. I feel like she did a good job of getting people behind her. She won three in a row, but maybe she was missing that big win as well. And the location, which is a massive, massive part of this, China. I mean, geez, we're not talking about like San Antonio here or some random city in America where, you know, a fighter is from. We're talking about China. This is like every promoter's dream to have a Chinese champion. Can't pass that up.
Yeah, and you know, let's be realistic about what's out there. Michelle Waterson isn't, you know, out of the title conversation with one more fight. Or if, you know, on the sidelines, it might be an opportunity for her to jump into the next title fight after that. There's not really, she doesn't lose anything. I think the momentum is still there for her, but I think she could solidify herself with another win.
The one that makes the most sense, of course, if Suarez isn't out for too long, have them fight each other, and there you have a number one contender fight. That makes all the sense of the world. I want to ask you about Chris Cyborg. On Monday, she was on the program talking about how, you know, she feels like Dana White's trying to damage her brand and, you know, how she's going to test the market. She wants to see what's out there. Do you think, win or lose, based on her comments, based on what Dana said on Saturday about her not wanting the Nunes fight, even though we clearly know she wants the Nunes fight, do you feel like, win or lose, this will be her last UFC fight?
No, I think it remains to be seen. I think Cyborg has dealt with, you know, that those comments are not recent, and the, you know, Dana White, Chris Cyborg adversarial relationship is not recent either. It stems back a long time, and she re-upped with the UFC at a previous point. So I don't really think that there's any ultimatum in this regard where, you know, win or lose, she's walking away. I think, you know, her and her team are smart negotiators. They're opening all their options. They're appearing at WWE wrestling events and trying to
AEW.
Make that
AEW.
Team,
get it right.
AEW. But no, she was at the WWE Performance Center previously.
Oh,
no,
yes.
Don't correct me if you're not going to be right. Listen.
You said events. You said events.
Okay, whatever.
It's not an event.
She was at the Performance Center.
All right.
And she was at AEW Wrestling. Clearly, she's trying to open other avenues up, not dissimilar to what Brock Lesnar has done in the past and making it seem like there's a realistic reason for them to walk away. But I think it's all negotiation. I don't ultimately think that Cyborg has a ton of leverage in this regard unless she can get somebody on the other side, whether it be another MMA organization or wrestling or whoever, to pony up, to say, we will, you know, pay you what you think you're worth, and for UFC to think that price tag is too high. Otherwise, I think she's coming back. So I think she'll ultimately go where the money is.
Yeah, although I feel like the relationship is in a pretty bad spot. And let's be honest, it's never been in a good spot, as you said, even from
That's
the get-go.
It's never been in a good spot, so there's nothing different now.
But there's only so much you can take, right? It just doesn't feel like they work hand-in-hand ever. It just doesn't feel like a good, a healthy relationship between promoter and fighter. Sure,
certainly not, but I think the UFC can offer her opportunities and money that others won't. We'll see if another promotion can come to the table.
You don't think Bellator? You think if she loses this fight, she's in a lot of trouble, right? Her stock is way low.
Yeah, her stock is hurt.
Two losses in a row. You're losing to someone who's good but relatively unknown. That will be a big deal. That will be a big blow. If she wins this fight and smokes Felicia Spencer, you don't think Scott Coker is going to pay her a lot? What about Ryzen? What about one championship? She'll have a lot of suitors, in my opinion.
If the money, you know, matches what value they can get out of her, I think the promotions are getting smarter and smarter about what the actual value of the athletes is. I could definitely see somebody like a one who you know, has now at this point been made it no secret that they are willing to pay top dollar to take away athletes that are valued, like a Sage Northcutt, who had, you know, a high profile and they paid handsomely for. Eddie Alvarez as another example. Demetrius Johnson traded for Ben Askren. I think that could be a potential avenue, but, you know, I don't think we know what Cyborg's value is, and I think we'll see at some point. She's going to test free agency, and we'll see who comes to the table.
All right. Thank you very much, New York Rick. I appreciate you doing this. Good to talk to you again. Talk to you next week.
It's good to talk to you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There he is, New York Rick, joining us. Appreciate his time, as always. Now let's say hello to an old friend joining us. It's been a while. He's so busy, I had to book him like 4 months in advance because the guy is just everywhere. He's omnipresent. He is the one and only, the man in the shirt, Jeff Wagenheim. Jeff, how are you?
Errol, it's been way too long.
You're yes.
Right. Yeah. Busy, busy life, but always got to make time for this kind of stuff just to be able to talk to you and also to talk to the fans directly. That's one of the things I'm not getting to do it as much anymore. You know, I'm working on stories and ideas and trying to present the best MMA coverage we can present out here on ESPN. But it's really great to actually talk to the people directly.
Yes. Well, we missed you, and I appreciate you doing this. I know you've been very busy, so thank you very much for the time. Want to ask you first, before we talk a little 238 and put that show to bed, what do you think of Chris Weidman moving up to 205? He told me that on Saturday. He just kind of crashed my radio show and said, yeah, he's going to do it. Of course, we know about the troubles he's had at 185. Do you like this move for him? He's never been a big 185er, but, you know, some of his weight cuts have been a little dicey. Do you feel like this is the right time for him to do that?
Yeah, well, he does seem to not have a real direct avenue to the top at his normal weight class. And you're right, he's not been a big guy for his weight class. However, as we learned on Saturday night and as we've learned in every single one of these champ versus champ fights, it's always the littler guy who wins the fight. And so I know your buddy Chael had a little thing on one of his podcasts talking about his about the theory of how it's a weight disadvantage as opposed to a weight advantage when a bigger person fights against a smaller person. And so, you know, maybe that plays into the next move for Chris Weidman. Maybe he will. While he'll be giving up any kind of size advantage, he'll be a little quicker than the guys above him. Who knows? It's just a fresh look for him, and maybe it'll just help push him forward. But you know, I'm no longer of that thought that guys who are a little smaller can't step up to the next weight class and have success, because we're seeing it, you know, like I said, in the champ versus champ fights, and also just people who've decided to no longer make a tough weight cut and are just going to go up one division and see how they do.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, like we were talking recently on the show about how 205 all of a sudden is really interesting, and we have Luke Rockhold yet to make his debut. We know about all the other young studs who have been doing very well as of late. But now you throw in another name, another familiar name, another former champion. It's a fun time at light heavyweight after, you know, a stretch where it was kind of getting a little bit stale. So I'm curious to see how that pans out. He says he's going to shoot for a return in October. I'm also curious to see who they match him up against. One of those young studs or maybe an older guy like a Glover Teixeira to try to, you know, get him a big win, a big name, and then put him in that title picture. Now, speaking of people who moved up, Henry Cejudo moved up on Saturday. He is now the bantamweight champion along with being the flyweight champion, along with being the Olympic champion. He's Triple C, Henry Cejudo. What a win for him over Marlon Moraes. Okay, so he's banged up and he's got options. There's no doubt about that. He's even talking about 145. If you're Henry Cejudo, what do you do next? Do you go back down to 125 and try to defend that title? Do you stick around at 135? Do you actually try to push for the 145 title? What do you do if you're him?
I think he's a guy who has, like you said, so many options that he's got to go for the biggest option, the one that's going to push him forward most. What did he talk about right after the fight and all the times after that, including when he came on to your program the other day? He talked about wanting to get paid. And one of the ways you get paid is by fighting against people who everybody wants to see you against, or maybe people who the fans think have a good shot against you. Like right now, after he went up there to 135 and won, while this I don't think is necessarily true, but I think there will be a bit of a perception that, well, he can go back down and just like bowl over everybody at 125. I don't necessarily agree with that, but perception is a big deal in the sport. And while one of the top guys down there is the last guy who beat him, Joe Benavidez. You know, I think that his opportunities may be to stick around at 135. I don't think a move up to one more weight class. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't sound like the kind of thing to do right now. But I think he could. I think he could create something at 135. I mean, that performance he put on the other night, the more I thought about it in the aftermath of it, It was pretty astounding. It really was, but it was not without its difficulties either. So he's got to recognize that he didn't just go out there and obliterate somebody like he did T.J. Dillashaw. He went out there and had a really, really tough time with Moraes for a while until he turned the tide. So it was kind of that's a mixed bag in my eyes. It's he can't look at the bantamweights and say, oh yeah, this is all mine. These guys just can't stick with me. Well, they might be able to stick with him, but he's just got the heart of a lion.
What about this? I mean, look, I don't love the idea of guys moving up and down because you're sort of monopolizing the titles and the divisions and you're holding things up. But I got to tell you, if Frankie Edgar beats Max Holloway on July 27th, there's not a big size difference there between right. Frankie Edgar and him. Now you'd be screwing over Volkanovski, and we don't know how healthy he is, and he would certainly warrant a title shot, and Holloway would warrant an immediate rematch as well. But it's not like the craziest thing to have him, an original flyweight, go a guy who won the Olympic gold at 121, fight at 145. I'm not putting it past him.
No, you're right. It's certainly not impossible. But I think a lot of moving parts would have to fall in the right spot.
Right.
And certainly, a Frankie Edgar fight would be pretty cool because, hey, that'd be a guy who's started at flyweight facing a guy who started at lightweight. I mean, it's not even, you know, forget about the featherweight. It's just because Frankie's a guy that came down despite not being a huge lightweight. So, yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line here is that the world is his oyster. And I'm talking about Henry Cejudo. The world is his oyster right now. He has, you know, he has transformed himself in the space of a few minutes, really, from, you know, he was kind of like the clown prince leading up to this fight with his costumes and you know, really trying too hard to promote himself, and I felt there was you know, his whole cringe thing, it's real. It was and it's not necessarily a good thing, but when you can back that up, you know, everything falls for you. I mean, that's really it. And if you can back it up in a way that he did, where, you know, to me this is a more impressive win than Dillashaw, because, you know, you can always always catch somebody. You know, I mean, I think that you know, Conor McGregor knocking out Aldo in 13 seconds. I mean, who knows how that fight goes if it goes a couple of rounds. Same with Dillashaw and Cejudo. Who knows what happens if he doesn't catch him right there. But we saw what happened in a Cejudo-Moraes fight, and we saw Cejudo getting kind of, really did not have an answer in that first round. It looked like this was not going to be his night. And then all of a sudden, Something changed. I mean, maybe it was strategy, but I think it was just his will. And that was the transformative factor. And when you get a guy who can will himself to victory like that, man, you know, you got something special.
Yeah, he is very special. I didn't expect this out of him. It's incredible to see the fighter that he has turned into, especially when you consider the injured ankle that he was dealing with. And that, I mean, that could have been a disaster for everyone involved. Imagine if he would have been so hurt that he couldn't fight and he hurt himself on the mats provided by the UFC, and he was able to overcome that even though it was very swollen. It was very black and blue, but, to see the way he was able to overcome that first round and do what he did in the second, then eventually the third, I'm very impressed with Henry Cejudo right now. Now, do you think, honestly, do you think, I know Dana White said it on Saturday, but do you think he'll ever defend that flyweight title? Because I still have my doubts.
Well, if Dana White said it, then we can pretty much take that as gospel. Is that not correct?
Right.
Has he ever said anything that didn't come true?
No.
No, I don't think so. You know what? I actually do not think he will.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, I'm not basing that on anything other than it just seems as though there's stuff lined up for him at bantamweight, and it would seem to me at least that if he's looking for money fights, then that's where he's gonna find them. And you know, I don't want him cherry picking. I'm not a big fan of champions cherry picking their challenges. I think champions have to take on the best person that's put in front of them, but there are plenty of options as best person to step in front of Henry Cejudo. And while there are some down at 125, I think there's more at 135.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if he gets what he's looking for. I know he threw out the threat that he would walk away if he doesn't get paid accordingly. But he does have a lot of momentum, a lot of leverage on his side now. So times are very interesting. And I have to say, honestly, I'm a little disappointed in the flyweights. I know there's only like 10 left, but where's the guy? Like, okay, Benavidez is fighting Formiga very soon. Like, why isn't anyone banging their chest right now? Why isn't anyone picking a fight with Cejudo? He's starting to become a star. He's starting to become one of the faces of this organization. Where are the flyweights trying to make a name for themselves? Clearly, look what Henry Cejudo did a year ago this time. No one really cared about Henry Cejudo in this sport. He was getting a title shot and people thought he didn't deserve it, a rematch against DJ. And look what he's done. Cringe or not, he's gotten people to care about him. And I don't see any flyweights doing that right now. I don't see a single one. Do you?
No, not really. But you know what? As much as we can, you know, I know that promotion and self-promotion are factors here. But the reason that Henry Cejudo is where he is right now is because he managed to eke out a very slim split decision victory over Demetrius Johnson, the pound-for-pound number one. But still, a win is a win. And then he managed to take out the bantamweight champion in, what was it, 32 seconds? I mean,
yep.
That's ultimately what got him where he is now. I mean, I know that promotion and talk and all that stuff enhances the stew here, but you got to have some substance there. And so, look, these guys at 125, they have to fight. They've got to go out there and fight and show that they're serious. If Joseph Benavidez goes out there and wins his fight in a really impressive way, he just can, you know, pound on his chest and say, hey, guys, look at the record. Look at the last guy who beat Henry Cejudo, and that's me. Mm. And then, you know, Henry Cejudo is going to have to think, okay, well, this is the one guy. This is a guy that I have not managed to beat. I mean, he's, you know, he lost to Demetrius Johnson, but then he came back and beat him. He needs to, you know, that's the wrong he would need to write if he was, you know, if that's the way he thought. I mean, that's not the money fight necessarily, but that's a fight that a guy like Henry Cejudo might be drawn into because he's a guy with a lot of pride, and he doesn't want somebody else to have a victory over him that he has not answered.
So earlier in the show, New York Rick and I were talking about Khabib, and of course Tony Ferguson comes up in that conversation. But now let me ask you specifically about Tony Ferguson, because like Henry Cejudo, he's got options, and probably, even though he's not a champion, lucrative options right now. He's won 12 in a row. He hasn't lost since 2012. Has the big win over Donald Cerrone. Very popular. Someone was telling me from EA that he's one of the top five most played characters on the EA UFC game. So people care about Tony Ferguson. Who do you think he'll fight next?
First of all, I'm kind of surprised that EA, the technicians impressed me, that they're able to actually replicate what Tony Ferguson does inside the cage. I mean, that seems like the kind of thing that you would have a hard time replicating in, you know, in any kind of animation. So the fact that they could do that is pretty impressive. And to me, there's only one answer. It's going for that title. I mean, come on. You're Tony Ferguson. You've won 12 in a row. even Habib, who has options, recognizes that this is the guy that should, that has to be, you know, right there in line, right after he fights Poirier. I mean, I know that there are other fights out there for Tony. There are other fights out there for Habib, but come on, if we're running a sport here, we can't be just saying, well, this is the fight that is most lucrative. At some point we have to say these two people who are winning and winning and winning, they have to collide at some point. This is not boxing. And this is one of the things that Dana White has said for years, that this is not boxing. We have the best fight the best. Well, let's see it.
So, and I just want to make sure that you understood the question. Of course he has to fight for the belt, but do you think that's what's going to happen? Like, do you believe that's what's going to happen? Habib is saying the right thing. Tony's saying the right thing. Do you foresee, as I said to New York Rick, I feel like they're both kind of boxing out Conor, and I feel like it's an interesting thing happening here where the money fight is now being trumped by the title fight. And this is an old way of thinking, of course, and this is something that I think a lot of people have been waiting for. But do you think if the UFC is sort of staring at a potential Conor McGregor return and he says that I'm only returning for this one fight only, that they would say no to him?
That's a good question. I think that the champion is old school and he wants to face the toughest guy he can face. He's already beaten up Conor McGregor. He's already, you know, dominated him for four rounds, well, three rounds, and had one round where he sort of took off. But, you know, he's already done that. And there's no reason other. I mean, let's set the money aside for a second. And there's no reason to make that rematch.
Right.
It was not like Conor McGregor was the champion that Habib dethroned. So there's no reason. And it wasn't as though this was a close fight. This was a relatively dominant performance. Not the most dominant performance I've ever seen. Certainly not the most dominant Habib has ever put on. But it was a very decisive victory. There's no reason to make that rematch unless you are just trying to get the money. And look, the UFC can make plenty of money by putting Habib and Tony Ferguson in the cage together if they promote it correctly. I mean, it's a lot easier to promote a Conor McGregor fight, but you can do it without having him in there. And I think that there may be a point at where you know Conor is, you know, Conor had the big payday in the boxing ring, and I get a feeling there's some level of discontent where he wants more money than the UFC is willing to give him, and maybe they can soothe him by giving him a title shot. But I just don't see it. I don't see how they can sell that to MMA fans. I think that maybe those casual people out there, the same people who would buy, you know, Conor against Mayweather, that kind of craziness, and there are a lot of them, but are you going to, do you really want to make your core fan base that disillusioned by ignoring the obvious title fight in just so you can make more millions? I mean, you're already going to make many, many millions by putting Habib and Tony, or, you know, let's not discount Dustin Poirier. It could be Dustin Poirier and Tony. You're still going to make a ton of money. And is it, do you really want to just say, well, we're just going to push that aside in order to make more? You know, if that's the way you're running the business, then you do it at the risk of losing some fans.
Well, Dustin winning would screw everything up, because then you can make the case that Habib deserves an immediate rematch. You can also make the case that Conor deserves the rematch against Dustin because he beat him at UFC 178. So that would be a huge wrench in all these plans. But I do hope that if Habib wins, that he sticks to his plan of returning in December, because I think that would make a lot of sense for Tony Ferguson to get that title shot in December. And quite frankly, to your point, Conor still makes a lot of money. You almost get, you know, you get two kicks of the can in the sense that you get the title shot, Habib's a draw, and then you have Conor fight against someone like, I don't know, Nate Diaz, Justin Gaethje, and you're still making a lot of money off of that. You could still headline a show easily with Conor McGregor because he is still the biggest draw in the sport, even bigger than any of the belts. But it does seem like we are starting to see a shift here, and I think a lot of fans, including yourself, would be very happy to hear about this, because this is something that we have talked about for quite some time.
Yeah, you and I know that this is always something that's been that I've always insisted that it's a sport and that we have to treat it like a sport. And I know you have many times said that Conor McGregor doesn't need to be in a title fight.
No.
So, I mean, I know he wants to get back a Khabib, and I actually admire Conor for wanting to get back in with a guy who so thoroughly beat him down. In the same way that I admired him when he would accept no fight other than a Nate Diaz rematch. I admire that, his competitiveness. However, in this case, because there's a title on the line, he just doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. And also, honestly, like, if I was a member of Conor's team, I wouldn't want to come back against Khabib. You need a win. You need a style that works well with your style, a winnable fight. I think a fight like Gaethje or Diaz makes a lot more sense for his comeback fight. Get that victory, and then let's talk about a rematch.
Yeah.
There doesn't have to be a rush. He's still just like 30 years old. There's no reason to jump back in there.
There's a ton of winnable fights for Conor McGregor. I mean, the guy is
right.
Fantastic fighter. Almost anybody within, you know, a couple of weight classes, almost any one of them would be a fight that he could win, or that he would be favored to win in. And I'm not saying he could never beat Khabib. It's just that he was beaten thoroughly enough in that first one, and there's no logical, you know, there's no logical reason from a meritocracy standpoint to put him back in there immediately. But hey, the guy can win a fight against anybody. So pick and choose. Find somebody that you think would be the real great money fight. Throw him in there.
Okay, one last thing. I was planning on asking you if you think there's anyone out there who can challenge Valentina Shevchenko, if there's anyone out there who is even on her level at 125. And then this morning I found out that they are talking about a Valentina Shevchenko versus Liz Carmouche fight in San Antonio on July 20th. Now, as of right this second, this fight is not a done deal, and we're taping this Wednesday afternoon. But they wanted Shevchenko. If Joanne Calderwood would have won, they would have done Calderwood versus Shevchenko, and Calderwood, of course, lost to Caitlin Chookagian on Saturday. Chookagian's getting married on September 7th, which is the same date as the Abu Dhabi card. And I heard that they want to have several female fights on the Abu Dhabi card. They need a main event for San Antonio. As of right this moment, Carmouche is scheduled to fight Roxanne Modafferi, but they need a main event. And there's a great story there. Liz Carmouche beat Valentina Shevchenko back in 2010. Liz Carmouche gave Valentina Shevchenko her first pro loss. And of course, lest we forget, Liz Carmouche was one half of the very first female fight in UFC history. And all of a sudden, look, I don't think Liz Carmouche is on Valentina's level at this juncture. I think Valentina is one of the most dominant fighters in the sport, regardless of weight class and gender. She is so good at 125, and what she did against Jessica Ai was kind of scary. But I kind of dig this fight. I don't hate it. What do you think?
I don't hate it either. I mean, any fight that Liz Carmouche is in, I'm going to watch.
She's
I will never forget that fight when she fought Ronda Rousey, because all we heard about was how great Ronda was, and we'd seen her be great ahead of then, and all of a sudden there was this moment of like, oh my God, Ronda Rousey is going to lose the first women's fight in UFC history. This is going to throw the hugest wrench into this entire thing. And of course, you know, then Ronda turned it around. Well, Liz is tough. I don't, you know, if I were putting a bet on the fight, I don't know that I would put a bet on her against Shevchenko. I think Shevchenko is so dominant. However, you know, I brought up the name Rousey. There was a time when the women's bantamweight division was Ronda Rousey and nobody. I mean, there were names, there were people who we knew who they were, but nobody could touch her. Nobody could come anywhere close to her. And then all of a sudden, one day, she got in there, you know, with Holly Holm, and that was the end of that, right? So there'll be a day when Shevchenko will meet her match. I don't know when that is. I don't know who it will be. But right now it looks like there's nobody who can touch her. And I guess we just have to live with that. I guess we have to just live with it and say, well, let's just put in with her the person who is most qualified to fight her. And right now Carmouche is one of the top-ranked people in that division. She like you said, she has that history with her. She's, you know, so why not? That's a fight to – what are you going to do? Are you just going to have her – you're just like have – Shevchenko and her belt sit there on the sideline waiting for contenders to come along? No, I think you just got to put her in there against the best that you can put up. And at some point, that division will catch up to her. Just like bantamweight caught up to Ronda. Just like, Joanna Jędrzejczyk looked like nobody could touch her at strawweight for a while.
Right. So, Demetrius Johnson as well.
Demetrius Johnson. All these divisions, you know, this hasn't happened to John Jones yet, but look at that bunch of young lions. At some point, maybe one of those guys can do something against John Jones. Who knows? So I think at some point, you just got to keep feeding the champion the best you can put in front of them and see how it plays out.
And I also don't hate, when you're trying to establish a new division, having a super dominant champion. It's not the worst thing in the world, because there is appeal to that. If it's boring fights and super close fights that, you know, nothing's happening, well, that's not very good. But if she continues to perform that way, and her fight against Joanna was fun, and obviously her debut against Priscilla Cachoeira was very one-sided, but she is going out there and doing spectacular things, and I also give her a lot of credit. She wants to fight. She wants to be active. And if they can figure out how to have her fight in Kyrgyzstan or nearby, where she's an absolute superstar, we saw those scenes not that long ago when she went home, presidents calling her after her fights, she'll come across as an even bigger superstar. So they have something on her hands with her, and Carmouche is not one to be intimidated or to back down. And again, if you can find the footage of their first fight, it happened, like I said, in 2010 for a promotion called C3 Fights. And she won by stoppage, by the way. Dr. Stoppage, I mean, there's a great story to be told there. So wow. I don't hate it. I really don't.
All right. That's a story I'm going to go work on. I'm going to go find somebody, you know, Brad or Mark or one of our guys, and we're going to work on that.
Yes. Now let's see if they actually get it done. But I do know that they're talking about it. And if they're listening, like I know they are, we'll let it be known that Jeff and Ariel are fans of this fight.
Well, has to be done then.
Yes. Now they're going to go opposite direction.
Once we say it's going to happen, you know it's going to happen.
Jeff, I appreciate it. Great stuff as always. Great to talk to you, and we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, Errol, great to talk to you as well.
All right, there he is, the man in the shirt, Jeff Wagenheim, my old pal. Great to have him back on the show, and I feel like we covered a lot of ground here today. This has been a fun show. A lot going on. A Gracie family member has not won a major title since Hodger Gracie won the one light heavyweight championship around 3 years ago. But it has been few and far between. Will Neiman Gracie get perhaps the most prestigious title that a Gracie family member can get? Maybe since Hoist Gracie won back in the day, the early UFCs. Now, he didn't win a title per se, but same kind of thing. It's a big one on Friday at Madison Square Garden. It was fun to talk to Josh Gross about it all. And by the way, for those wondering, John Fitch is in New York. He will be weighing in. He is there as an alternate, but as of right now, the Rory McDonald-Neiman Gracie fight is on. This is something that the UFC does quite often, just in case someone pulls out. I know there was some talk. My pal Chael Sonnen kind of fueled this fire a little bit, saying that Fitch was here to fight. He's just here to weigh in, make weight, and then if something happens, God forbid, he'll step in. But for now, that main event is on. Like I said, top to bottom, it's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to being back at the Mecca. Home to your 2020 NBA champion New York Knickerbockers on Friday. Thank you very much to Josh Gross. Thank you very much to New York Rick. Appreciate him stopping by as always. And again, thank you very much to Jeff Wagenheim. Please rate, subscribe, review, download, all those things and more. This show, the Monday show, here on Apple Podcasts, the app, wherever you download your podcast, we appreciate the love. We appreciate the support, as always. Fun show in the books. I'm back next week. Monday, usual show. Wednesday, usual show. We also have Ariel the Bad Guy on ESPN+. A boatload of things for you to consume. Enjoy the fights this weekend. I'll talk to you next week.